You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, does the idea of riding in a driverless vehicle make you a little nervous? Our guest tells us about his recent test drive here in Wisconsin. Now, the state Supreme Court heard testimony yesterday from lawyers and judges from around the state who say that pay for public defenders is way too low. They say the rates for those attorneys are the lowest in the nation, and that's keeping people from receiving their constitutional rights. Sean Johnson is the Capitol Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Public Radio News. He's covering this issue. Sean, welcome back.
Hey, Rob.
Talk about what happened at the Supreme Court, the state Supreme Court, yesterday.
What they had was a rules petition hearing. And so you've got some attorneys who have petitioned the Supreme Court to raise the amount that we pay court-appointed attorneys in Wisconsin. And this was a chance for them to go before all seven justices and members of the public to sign up and go testify and say, do this or don't do it. And mostly we heard from lawyers and judges saying, please, this is overdue.
And this is a little kind of a different thing for the state Supreme Court. Usually when something comes there, somebody has sued somebody else, and then it moves up the court hierarchy to them. This is their role as the overseers of what happens in courts around the state, and officers of the court, judges and attorneys brought this up in that context.
Exactly. And it's a key difference as far as the justices are concerned. I mean, the way that they view it anyway, because this is a petition, as you mentioned. It's a group of people asking the court to set a rule. So the court, at least several of the justices said that in that context, they were unwilling to just say, we, the Wisconsin Supreme Court, find the current system for paying defense lawyers unconstitutional, that if they were going to take that step, and they didn't say that they would, but if they were, they'd want to see a case make it up to the court.
Now let's talk about the issue. People have been talking about this for a while. Public defenders in Wisconsin, these are attorneys who say, yes, I will represent this often low income client for the set rate. How do we compare to the rest of the country?
We are the lowest. I mean, $40, which is what the state public defender pays private attorneys to take public defender cases, is the lowest in the nation. You did hear somebody who represents defense lawyers nationally talk about his own state's battle to raise the $40 rate like back in the 90s. You know, so this is something that other states have already raised considerably, but we haven't in Wisconsin.
And their case is not just lawyers aren't making enough money, but that this is making it harder for people to get representation. That's kind of at the heart of their argument, right?
Yeah. I mean, if you're an attorney there were attorneys who spoke who have small private practices in northern Wisconsin, for example. And one of the messages you heard was, look, I spent $250,000 on law school for the right to do this. I would like to take more public defender cases, but I can't when I basically have to pay for the right to take them.
And are they making a constitutional argument here saying that for defendants, if these lawyers aren't available because of this low rates, this doesn't give them their due process?
That is the problem. So right now, especially in a number of northern Wisconsin counties where it's really hard to get public defenders, you'll have people sit in jail for 6 to 7 weeks, one judge said, that he has people sit in jail for that long while they wait for an attorney. So that is a pretty clear violation of their Sixth Amendment right under the U.S. Constitution. They are supposed to have that right to counsel. And if they can't afford it, that's where public defenders come in.
Talking to Sean Johnson from WPR News about a hearing yesterday before the state Supreme Court on what public defenders are paid by the state. Sean, does the state Supreme Court have the power to raise the pay for any or all public defenders?
For some of them, yes. Specifically for public defenders. So the way it breaks down in Wisconsin is you have these public defenders or private attorneys who are paid by the state public defender. That's who gets the $40 per hour. That is under the purview of state government, the state. And it's, I think, pretty clearly the legislature and the governor's call to decide whether or not that funding gets increased. So what the court can do is there's this other group of attorneys for people who don't fall into the category of needing a public defender, but nevertheless need an attorney. There are court-appointed attorneys. They get paid $70 an hour in Wisconsin, which is still low nationally. So this petition says to the Supreme Court, raise that $70 rate right now from $70 an hour to $100 an hour. And that is something that the court could do, arguably at least, unilaterally, is tell counties, county judges, right now, this is the rate that we pay for these court-appointed attorneys.
What did the state Supreme Court justices say to that idea?
The big thing, you heard from all the justices who spoke was, we agree that this is a problem. I mean, you didn't really hear any dispute of that on the court. They all seemed to agree that this was a problem. It was just a question of whether or not they felt like they could do anything about it as the court, whether they could step in and tell counties, spend all this money, or especially with the state, whether they could step in and say, the state public defender, you're going to raise the rates because we say so, because things are bad.
Right, because one thing the state Supreme Court doesn't really have is a budget to do any of this. They can't fund the pay for these attorneys.
Yeah, that's their argument. They don't have, in their words, the power of the purse, that is the role of the governor and legislature. And even though you've heard a number of legislators say, public defender pay is an issue in Wisconsin, they haven't come forward and passed a bill or put it in the budget to spend more money on them.
We've talked to lawmakers here on the show from rural areas, especially up north, who say there's a problem for people hiring attorneys, period. Public defenders, somebody to write their will, whatever. Have lawmakers tried to do something about this public defender pay issue itself?
It comes up off and on. And I mean, in this last session, there was actually also talk about increasing the number of assistant district attorneys throughout the state. You know, anytime there's money involved, state money involved, especially, there's resistance, that it competes against other priorities. In the case of the court-appointed attorneys, this step that the court could take, for example, that would cost an estimated $32 million a year if they did that step tomorrow, and that would be borne entirely by Wisconsin counties. So the Wisconsin Counties Association is against this. They said, look, we agree that there's a problem and that rate is low, but if you go ahead and do this tomorrow, we are going to be saddled with a $32 million annual bill with no extra state money. And that's just not fair to us. We're going to have to cut back on other priorities.
Now, by analogy, you've been covering redistricting court challenges. And one option for courts in redistricting cases is to say, your map is bad, you have to redraw it. But we're not going to redraw the map for you. Is it an option, do you think, for the state Supreme Court to say, this pay is bad, it's creating an unconstitutional condition for some citizens? We can't say pay X amount, but we can say fix it by this date and bring back your plan to us.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like petitioners are looking for the court to take some type of a leadership role. And if the court does that and says this is just, this is a crisis, a constitutional crisis, that with that leadership, the legislature might step in and say, okay, here's money. But this is not a lawsuit. This is right. Not people who have come forward and said, my Sixth Amendment rights are being violated because I'm sitting in jail for seven weeks without an attorney. Now, it's kind of a catch-22 situation, chicken before the egg, whichever one.
Right.
Those people can't come forward because they don't have a lawyer.
Right. I mean, find an attorney to challenge the fact that you don't have an attorney.
Right, exactly. So, one of the judges from Northern Wisconsin who spoke yesterday said he keeps waiting for somebody to file a motion in his court. Somebody's been sitting in jail for 6 or 7 weeks and say, my rights are being violated, let me out now. But when you don't have a lawyer, that motion never comes.
Do we have a timeline on a decision, a reaction to this petition from the state Supreme Court?
We don't. We don't know what they're going to do or when. They did address this issue a little bit in 2011. And at the time, they said that a crisis is coming. Something needs to be done. And here we are, 7 years later, and nothing's been done. So, they could take another step like that where they sound a warning, but it's happened before and nothing happened.
We'll leave it there for now. Sean, thanks a lot for joining us.
All right. Thanks, Rob.
Sean Johnson is the Capitol Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Public Radio News. He joined us today to talk about testimony at the Wisconsin Supreme Court yesterday from lawyers and judges who say that low pay for public defenders in the state keeps lawyers from picking up cases. First, we're getting closer and closer to sharing the road with driverless vehicles. It was reported this week that Apple now has permits to test 55 self-driving cars in California. That puts it far ahead of Waymo, which is Alphabet's line of autonomous vehicles. That's the Google company. Those companies and others are racing to get driverless vehicles tested and ready for the road. So what's it going to be like to ride in a vehicle that has no driver? Alex Moe is a reporter for WISBusiness.com. He found out firsthand when he rode a shuttle made by the French manufacturer Navya on the UW-Madison campus. Alex, welcome to Central Time.
Sure, thanks for having me.
So how did you get the chance to get this a demo ride in a driverless vehicle, an autonomous vehicle?
Right, this was a really good experience for me, really fun. I was able to try out a ride in an autonomous vehicle from a French manufacturer called Navya, UW-Madison, which is one of 10 federally designated proving grounds for autonomous vehicles in the country. They put on an opportunity, a two-day opportunity for people to come in and check out the shuttle, see what it's like, and it was a really unique opportunity.
And does this thing follow a standard route?
For this test, it was following a standard route. On the UW-Madison campus, it was just doing a quick loop of one of the blocks on campus.
And anybody who's ever driven on the UW campus knows, you know, it's not just an easy straightaway. There are lots of challenges and obstacles that pop up. Is this part of why they picked it?
Right. I believe it is. And the system engineer that I spoke with, who's part of the UW-Madison Traffic Operations and Safety Lab, he said that they were really trying to get a sense for how this vehicle would interact with other vehicles and people on the road, people on bikes, you know, little kids, all the sort of things that any regular car has to deal with. So it was a chance for them to see how the vehicle would interact with some of those things and just get really valuable data from those interactions.
So you're on board. Paint us a picture here. What is this looking like from the perspective of a passenger on this sort of like a minibus, right?
Sure, yeah. It felt like being on a small bus, kind of like any other shuttle. If you go in a big city or big corporate campus, they have shuttles. It felt like being on one of those. The only difference was rather than having someone sitting in front of a steering wheel, we had a guy kind of standing next to a sort of control panel. And at that panel, he would give the vehicle input for the vehicle would ask him if it was basically okay to move forward when it would stop at stop signs and other obstacles like that. So it was an autonomous vehicle with a person basically guiding it as an operator rather than a driver. And had about 10 other people on the shuttle with me. Everyone was very excited. That was one of the best parts about it, was kind of seeing the community engagement and the level of excitement we had. Just on there were people there kind of my age, college student age, and then some folks who were quite a bit older, and everyone had a lot of questions, and it was really fun.
Now there's an operator there who can override stuff, and we'll talk about kind of how this worked in a minute, but you're sitting there, you know that in effect the robot is driving the vehicle. Was that a little weird? Was there a sense of apprehension there?
Yeah, you know, it was kind of weird. I admit I was a little apprehensive, and the ride itself wasn't, I guess, the smoothest thing in the world. It was a little jerky, like you might imagine a teenage driver just getting a feel for the pedals, but I didn't feel unsafe at all, and we went up against some situations where even a human driver might have to stop and think or take some extra caution, so the vehicle was definitely tested.
Talking to Alex Moe, reporter for WISBusiness.com. He took a test ride in an autonomous vehicle on a testing ground in Madison. So what were some, Alex, of the weirdest moments? What threw off the autonomous vehicle the most?
Yeah, there was one really interesting moment where myself and the other passengers were really interested to see what would happen. I could tell because everyone perked up. When we reached one corner, there was a group of really young kids there with two chaperones or teachers or whatever, and they approached the corner and they were looking at us. They saw a kind of a unique looking vehicle, and we were all looking at them because we wanted to see how the vehicle would deal with a crowd of kids basically going up to the edge of the road, and we didn't know if they were going to try to cross or anything like that. But the shuttle ended up needing to stop because they approached too close to the corner, and you know how kids do, they're standing kind of with their feet poking over the edge of the curb, and the vehicle actually stopped itself. So at that point, our operator had to pull out an Xbox controller that was kind of hardwired in there and take over and pull us around the corner. And then the autonomous system took over again quite smoothly.
How does the vehicle know that there's kids or a bike or a car or whatever? What's its detection system to know what's out there?
That's a good question. This vehicle in particular used LIDAR, which is a laser detection system, and video cameras basically to keep track of what's around it and scan for any obstacles in its path.
And it's got, I guess, built-in parameters. Oh, human-shaped obstacle too close to the curb. In this case, car in front of me. It's got all this, I guess, probably fairly complicated programming, right, to say what it should do when it detects things in a certain range?
Yeah, exactly. And I believe the Navia people who were kind of in charge of the vehicle, who were working in partnership with the university engineers and scientists, they had set up the route in advance, and they input specialty areas such as crosswalks where people might be kind of walking into the road without warning. And at those areas, the vehicle would slow down, and very noticeably, where our operator had to warn us in advance, basically, so that we wouldn't get scared of it, kind of like stopping abruptly when there was nothing there. But it was so those kind of areas can be input in advance with this type of vehicle, so that it approaches certain intersections and areas more cautiously.
Let's talk about some other possible obstacles. There are a lot of bicycles are in this that part of campus. Did that come up at any point?
Yeah, I saw a couple people on bikes going by, and really that was almost, there was nothing to notice there, because they might have not even noticed it was an autonomous vehicle. I think when it comes to bikers on campus, anyone who drives around UW-Madison frequently, they know that the students like to go into the road quite a bit on bikes and walking, and the shuttle definitely did not seem to have any issue with scanning for those obstacles and cautiously sort of slowing down when they got too close or got in front of us.
Hey, the operator, was he or she sitting where a driver usually would? Like, if I was looking from the sidewalk, I'd see somebody in that position I'd expect a driver to be in, right?
So that's actually an interesting thing. There wasn't exactly a designated seat or spot for a driver, so to speak. He was standing up kind of in the corner where three sides of the interior of the shuttle had seats, kind of like bus seats and hand grips. And then he was standing up sort of in the corner, almost in an awkward position where it didn't really seem like the vehicle was built for having someone standing there, where he was almost standing in front of some of the riders. So that was kind of an interesting thing. I think it's sort of they're still testing these things out, and they're still trying to figure out like where exactly the operator or driver should be and what role they should play. So that seems like something that's still getting figured out.
So were there any like of those movie style double takes where somebody looks and looks back like, hey, no, there's nobody driving that thing?
I didn't notice anybody giving us any too crazy looks, but I did notice that all those little kids, they were definitely excited, and they could tell that it was a different kind of vehicle. So it's funny. It might be the young people more so that can spot these things.
You wrote that another issue that came up was, I think it was a parked car on the side and not enough room for the autonomous vehicle to get through without crossing the center line. What happened?
So that's actually, that was something I heard from the system engineer who I spoke with, who was there kind of in attendance answering questions from community members who arrived. And he told me that was something that he had noticed, that the shuttle wouldn't kind of take the liberty of kind of just scooting around a car that had been parked on the side of the road such that it was blocking one side. So the shuttle was basically too apprehensive and wouldn't cross the center line. So that's a situation where the driver would have to take over. And I didn't see that firsthand, but that was something that that John Reel, he's with Traffic Operation and Safety Lab at UW-Madison, he said that's something that can be worked on and could be improved upon, that sort of tentativeness and I guess not being able to sort of bend the rules.
Now, talking to the engineers and the people involved with this, do you get any sense of any kind of timeline where they're thinking after X amount of months or years from now, we could put this thing on the road with or without an operator?
You know, that's a really good question, and that's a question that a lot of the people who are kind of working in this space are trying to answer right now. So I've heard from pretty much everyone who's involved with this, especially scientists and researchers, that it's coming either way. And one thing that you don't hear much is a specific number of years, you know, before we're going to see self-driving cars with just on the consumer level, just on the streets of Wisconsin. So that remains to be seen, I think. But I know that people are doing their best to get to the point where we can have a safe operation of these vehicles. And on another note, Foxconn wants to have self-driving trucks going between its Mount Pleasant facility and the airport in Milwaukee as early as 2021. So we could be seeing this kind of pop up in a couple different areas, depending on where you're looking over the next couple years. You know, as early as within 5 years, I could expect to see some of these things on the road in Wisconsin.
Having had this up close experience, would you feel comfortable, on the one hand, going for a ride on one of these outside of a designated area, and or being a driver on the road, knowing these things are on the road with you?
I do feel like I would feel safe riding in one, especially, and probably even more so with just having them on the road around with me, because, you know, the issues of safety that everyone is worried about are very reasonable. There have been some really high-profile cases where self-driving vehicles have made big mistakes and people have gotten hurt and killed, and it's very reasonable why people would be scared. But it's something that seems like it's going to happen either way, you know, and as the safety gets tuned and improved, that's only going to be something that people are hopefully becoming more and more comfortable with as they go. And I think I'll be quite comfortable with it as long as everybody else is.
Alex, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Alex Moe is a reporter for WISBusiness.com. He covers tech, research, startups, and general business news from around the state. He also produces a weekly show, WISB Business, the podcast. We talked to him about his recent ride in a self-driving shuttle on the UW-Madison campus. Israel is being accused by Palestinians and many in the global community of using excessive force on Palestinian protesters this week. 60 Palestinians were killed along the border between Israel and the Gaza Strip following the opening of the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem. Israel says its troops acted in self-defense and blamed the militant group Hamas, which rules Gaza, for the deaths. On Tuesday, we talked about the demonstrations with a former Israeli Foreign Service official. Susan Abulhawa joins us now. She's a Palestinian-American writer, author of the best-selling novel Mornings in Jenin. She's also the founder of Playgrounds for Palestine, which built playgrounds in Palestine and UN refugee camps in Lebanon. Susan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Before we get to the protests themselves and the violence, can you talk about the move of the U.S. opening its embassy in Jerusalem? What do you make of that move?
Well, I mean, it contravenes international law. It contravenes U.S. standing policy for the past 70 years or so. It's unjust. You know, Jerusalem had historically been, prior to the establishment of Israel, an open city where Muslim Jews and Christians, various sects of Christianity, in fact, all lived in relative harmony. And really, the establishment of Israel has reversed that, and to a really tragic degree, in a way that that gives privilege to Jews of the world over other indigenous people who have lived there. And by moving the embassy there, the United States is really kind of is legitimizing that kind of exclusivity, that ethno-religious supremacy.
I want to give a listen to U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., Nikki Haley. She defended Israel's response to protests, speaking before the Security Council earlier this week. Here's a listen.
Those who suggest that the Gaza violence has anything to do with the location of the American embassy are sorely mistaken. Rather, the violence comes from those who reject the existence of the State of Israel in any location.
Susan, what's your response to what we heard there from Ambassador Haley?
So Palestinians in Gaza have been very explicit about their reason and their motivation for protesting on their own land in Gaza. And it is their expressed reason is to return to their homes. Israel has had Gaza under a terrible, suffocating siege for the past 11 years, whereby they have been calculating literally the caloric intake, allowing a minimal amount of food for people to sustain themselves. Not allowing building materials, school materials, particular medicines, controlling every aspect of Palestinian lives, not allowing fishermen to actually fish in the deep sea, relegating them to less than 3 nautical miles where there's hardly any fish. I mean, every aspect of Palestinian life in Gaza has been curtailed. People can't leave, can't go to study. People, you know, and that's not to even mention the bombing campaigns. It's just utterly hideous, horrible, murderous bombing campaigns that they've launched over the years against a principally defenseless civilian population. And as a result of that, over 11 years, there's been increasing despair in Gaza. People have electricity for less than 4 hours a day. 100% of the water resource is unfit for drinking. There's 50% unemployment. People have no hope. Half of children under the age of 5 have no will to live. And this has been imposed by Israel. Gazans have gone to this fence. It's not even a border. Israel has no internationally recognized borders because they've refused to declare their border. So this is a fence that Israel has put up. It's 3 layers of electrified fence, and Palestinians went there to protest their condition, to demand their right to return to their homes. Now, these are mostly refugees in Gaza who were expelled by Israel when Israel was created, and has been occupying their homes and their villages since. And they have that right. That's a right enshrined in international law. The Palestinians have told us why they're taking this action. It's not up to Nikki Haley or anybody else to explain their motivations after they've already explained what they're doing and why they're doing it. And it ought to be, frankly, self-evident to anybody who understands, who's been watching what's happening in Gaza for the past 10 years.
Susan Abulhawa is with us now talking about the latest news from Gaza and Israel after the move of the American embassy to Jerusalem. Susan, Israel has blamed the violence over this week on the group Hamas. They say they are encouraging civilians to approach the border. They're using them as human shields, in effect, so militants can slip past the border and endanger people on the other side of it, on the other side of these fences. What do you say to that?
First of all, this started before the U.S. embassy move. Palestinians are marking the 70th anniversary of the Nakba, which is the catastrophe when they were expelled from their homes and replaced with foreign Jews from all over the world who had absolutely no familial, historic, or ancestral connection to the land. You know, and I really don't know why U.S. media, I mean, with respect, I don't understand why people continue to repeat this trope, this red herring about Hamas. It's as if, you know, Palestinians, like, we don't have agency, as if all these people can't think for themselves. And even if Hamas were to tell people to demonstrate and resist and even fight back, it would not be wrong. It would be right, because we have a right to defend ourselves too. We have a right not to be imprisoned in the world's largest open air prison. We have a right to life. We have a right to aspire to a better future. So even if they did that, even if Hamas told people to go, even if they were behind this, even let's just say for the sake of argument that none of us, that we don't have a civil society and none of us can think for ourselves and nobody has any kind of will of their own and we're just kind of robots following Hamas, even if that were true, it would not be wrong. It would not be wrong for us to defend ourselves against. And the second part of that is, you know, how people can still entertain the idea that Israel is defending itself when there has not even been a single injury of Israelis, and there are 12,000, over 12,000 bodies that are either murdered or maimed, missing eyes, missing limbs, lacerated spinal cords. Do you have any idea what that looks like? 12,000 human beings. and we're still saying Israel is defending itself? I mean, it beggars the mind. It's difficult for me to fathom how we can continue in this discourse in the face of evidence that ought to just, you know, preclude this kind of language. And if the roles were reversed, can you imagine what if the roles were reversed, if Palestinians had killed that many Jewish people?
Susan Abulhawa is with us, Palestinian-American writer, author, and activist. We're talking about the opening of the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem this week and ongoing protests in Gaza. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your reaction to the news we're seeing there along the fence between Israel and Gaza? How do you think the Trump administration should respond? How hopeful are you for the prospects of peace in the region? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. We're talking about this week's protests in Gaza. Susan Abulhawa is with us, Palestinian-American writer and author of the novel Mornings in Jenin, founder of Playgrounds for Palestine, which builds playgrounds in Palestine and UN refugee camps in Lebanon. You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. What role do you think, if any, do you think the United States should be playing? What do you make of what the Trump administration is doing in terms of moving the embassy and other actions in the Middle East? You can join in at 800-642-1234. We'll go to our callers now. John is with us in Madison. John, hi.
Hi, guys. I just want to say I completely agree with your guest's viewpoint. And One issue that I think people oftentimes don't realize is that collective punishment of populations of people is expressly prohibited by, I don't know which one of the Geneva Conventions, but it's expressly prohibited by the Geneva Conventions. What Israel is arguing is that what's happening to Gaza is Hamas's fault. So Israel is doing exactly what's prohibited by the Geneva Convention. They're punishing collectively all of the people of Gaza and saying, well, look at Hamas. It's Hamas's fault. That's forbidden by the Geneva Conventions, and I wish people realized that, and I wish, you know, the media would talk about that angle of the situation. Thank you.
John, thanks for your call. Susan, your thoughts.
Well, he's right. It is prohibited by the Fourth Geneva Convention. And so is the kind of shoot to kill actions that they're doing, this kind of wanton sniper shooting at unarmed demonstrators. And people think that, you know, these people, that Palestinians are just coming at them and attacking them. And the Palestinians are actually like more than 3 football fields away from any soldier. So they are literally behind fortified positions, putting human beings in their aim and shooting. They're shooting at limbs, they're shooting at heads, and at least one video of that was leaked from the other side in which they were high-fiving each other for getting a good shot. And when that video leaked and went viral, rather than actually investigate or punish the sniper who was basically hunting human beings and celebrating the kill, Israel decided to punish the person who videotaped it and said that, well, that's how, you know, they're just venting. It's a stressful situation and they're venting, and that's how they let off steam, is to celebrate, you know. So, I mean, this is the mentality of Israel.
John, thanks for the call. Susan, are you hopeful? Do you want to see a United Nations or other international organization investigate what happened there this week?
Well, there was a motion put forth in the Security Council to launch an investigation into the killings, but the United States, of course, squashed it and prevented that from going through. And you know, I say, as we often do, you know, if Israel has nothing to hide, then why not allow an investigation? but they do have a lot to hide. And so they have obstructed nearly every UN investigation. But nonetheless, I mean, there are plenty of human rights organizations who have who go in and who collect testimonies and statements. And for decades, they have been documenting hideous human rights abuses. I mean, Israel actually has one of the worst and most consistent human rights records in the world. And yet, people don't understand that in this country because the narrative that's put forth always is that this is a vibrant democracy, et cetera, et cetera. And this is, you know, this kind of narrative is pushed, is by design. It's pushed by highly funded PR campaigns. I mean, one of the most recent is this kind of art washing or culture washing, where they bring in international artists or they engage their own artists in international arenas to obscure what they're doing to Palestinians.
Right, you're calling on the orchestra. You're in the Philadelphia area. The local orchestra, they are, I think, planning a trip to play in Israel, and you're calling on them to cancel that.
Exactly. Yeah. So the Philadelphia Orchestra is going to Israel. They're leaving next week, actually, and we had a letter sent to them about 2 months ago, 3 months ago, signed by over 100 individual personalities and 35 social justice organizations, including Black Lives Matter, Black and Brown Workers Collective, Real Justice Coalition, Jews for Justice, Jews for Peace, sorry. And they weren't interested in speaking with us. They're getting $2 million from the Jewish Federation and to collaborate with the State of Israel. And so they're going with that. And in response, we've taken to the streets to protest. For 7 weeks, we've had sustained protests against them, and this is the kind of collaboration and the kind of lending, the kind of art washing, lending music and art and culture to whitewash war crimes. It's horrible.
Susan Abulhawa is with us talking about Gaza and Israel. Back to your calls now. Mark is with us in Mineral Point. Mark, hi.
Yeah, good afternoon. I'm really glad to hear the Palestinian voice on this issue because of all the international issues covered in the U.S. media, the issue of Palestine, the Palestinians, and the conflict with Israel is the most disgracefully unfair of any of the issues there on the international scene. The Palestinian point of view is almost never represented. And
I'm going to jump in. It's not a great signal. I don't know if you can make it out. Susan, he was making the case that the Palestinian point of view is underrepresented in the American media.
Thank you for clarifying, because I was having a hard time hearing. It absolutely is underrepresented in U.S. media. And the proof of that is the fact that the average American doesn't understand that that Israel is an occupying force. They don't understand that Israel was formed by European Jews who had never been in Palestine, who had no familial or ancestral connection to Palestine, and in that formation, in doing so, removed the indigenous Muslim and Christian population. And the way it's presented in U.S. media is as if Palestinians are trying to usurp indigenous people or something, and so, as if Palestinians are the ones occupying the land, as if Palestinians are the aggressors, when in fact, you know, Palestinians have no military, no army, no real weapons, nothing. Pitted against one of the most technological death industries in the world, and it's, you know, I don't understand U.S. media. I don't understand how the degree of complicity that mainstream media is when it comes to Israel.
I'll go to another caller now. Lisa is with us in Milwaukee. Lisa, hi.
Hello. I would just like to suggest a different strategy, political strategy, for the Palestinian people, because the one that they're using now is just not working. And I would just like to preface my remarks by saying that decades ago, I was a Zionist. I am now pro-Palestinian. This is my spiritual perspective, because I'm a kind of person who is on the side of the underdog. So the strategy that I think would be much more effective in gaining the Palestinian rights, stopping the settlement, stopping turning Palestinian land into cantonments where they can no longer live and just being usurped by what is the Jewish state now, would be to stop burning tires and stop throwing stones with slingshots. Go to that wall. Everyone go. All the thousands with the children and hunger strike. The Israeli activists, the peace activists, will come from the other side, on their side of the wall, and they will do the same.
Lisa, I want to jump in because we're just about out of time. Susan, briefly, your thoughts, a passive resistance approach, I guess Lisa is calling for.
Yeah, I think people can, oppressed people are the better architects of their own resistance. Those tactics that you're talking about are actually in place and they're ongoing, and none of the things you're talking about actually happened. There have been weekly protests in Bil'ain, for example, that have been going on for the past 12 years or so, and we're not getting the result that you think we're having. The problem is that power doesn't. When Israel gets to act with impunity, that's what they do. And there's nothing, there's no real power standing in the face of Israel to stop and cease. And Palestinians have only their bodies. And Palestinians have every right to sling stones, to do whatever. I mean, frankly, it is passive resistance. Those rocks are totally symbolic. And anybody, any sentient being, anybody with a heart, should be able to see that. These are people who have no control over their lives, who have been watching their neighbors and loved ones and parents and siblings just die by the hundreds every single day as if they're vermin, as if their lives don't matter.
Thanks to Susan Abulhawa, Palestinian-American writer and author of the novel Mornings in Jenin, also founder of Playgrounds for Palestine. We talked with her about the opening of the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem, protests along the Gaza-Israel border. Earlier in the week, we talked to a former representative of the Israeli Foreign Service. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll round up some of the top stories of the week in Wisconsin news, including the results of this week's special election primaries. And we'll meet some of the earliest women pioneers in the automotive world, driving, selling, and racing cars in an era when some men thought women shouldn't drive at all. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.